I'm going to tell you what I don't like about Game of Thrones. And, well, I'm going to tell you what I love. Because I want to tell you about the story of the young wolf and the bridge of the Twin Towers and the hidden lion. Now, if you're a Game of Thrones listener, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And the whole reason I'm going to say this, or I'm saying what I'm saying at all, is to drive home the potent imagery of standards. And by that, I don't mean morality. I mean sigils. I mean crests. I mean an image behind which your identity lies. Now, first, a fair game here, right? Game of Thrones is awful. There's just some real evil there. And this has several different levels. And the first is, if you are a human being of weak stomach or particular lusts, without question, the HBO series is one you need to stay away from. Yeah? It is, it's not NC-17, but it's a solid R. And for good reason. And frankly, I could do without most of that. Although, frankly, there's a lot of PG-13 out there that you probably let your kids watch, which glorifies sexuality. Forget PG-13. Just the music videos they're watching and listening to. Which glorifies sexuality far more than anything in Game of Thrones. One of the weird things about it, and again, not for the weak of stomach, but HBO has done a pretty good job of very rarely making it pornographic. Most times, it's actually kind of real. And if you're married, then you know that's not always... how do you say this, right? Well, it's not fantasy. Now, that doesn't mean we need to watch it or that it's good to watch it as Christians, right? But it is it's certainly a different thing than, say, half the Super Bowl commercials. So there's that issue. And by all means, in Christian freedom, abstain. Yeah, in Christian freedom, you can probably also endure. And if you're going to say, well, you can't do it without sin, really? Really? You can do anything without sin? So when my wife and I watch Game of Thrones together and those moments come up, pretty much I look at my wife. I hold my wife's hand, I give my attention to other things, and if there is dialogue I need to hear for the story, I try to listen to that too. Now, you go ahead and condemn us if you need to. The other thing about Game of Thrones that's just awful that most people don't think twice about, in fact, we'll take our kids, our youngest kids, to go see, what, Avengers Infinity Gauntlet? Is the violence. We've gotten so seduced by the violence as if it's not really, breaking the fifth commandment. So if you got a problem with watching people break the sixth commandment, even in implication, then why don't you have a problem with watching people break the fifth commandment? And I'm not saying this so that you never watch TV. I'm saying this at a certain point, you got to check your hypocrisy at the door and recognize where you've made lines that there aren't lines. Or where you're willing to judge others before you've been willing to look at that log in your own eye. So the violence in Game of Thrones, it actually isn't that violent overall. There's a little bit of gore. But what you see, and this is then, awful as it is, the reason I love it as a show and as a story. You see a brutal honesty with regards to the condition of wicked humanity. And this isn't like melodramatic worm tongue in The Two Towers where he's so evil you can tell, just look at him, look how evil he is, all he does is evil. No, this is like people you like that are complex characters who also do wicked things, like betray each other or lie for their own benefit while also being wicked things. In fact, the antagonists in the story, some of the worst people in the story are the most loyal, committed family members who watch each other's back and care for their children and the future of their name, which is a virtuous thing. So what I love about it is you have the complexity of reality taking place in the story before you. Which is also then what I hate about it, because, well, and spoilers incoming, so, I mean, if you haven't watched it yet, it means you're not going to, right? Just like reality. In Game of Thrones, the good guys don't always win. And so the story of the young wolf who was betrayed at the Red Wedding by the family whose sigil is a bridge with two towers, at the behest of the lion. Well, golly, it broke my heart. See, there's this character. Well, I guess there's a few, but there's a character who's a wolf. He's a main character of the first book, and you love him. You love him because he's good. He's probably the only really good one amongst the main crew that starts off the story. And by the end of the first book and the end of the first season, I told you, spoilers incoming, turn it off right now. It's your last chance. Okay. But at the end of the first book and the end of the first season, he's dead. And it's a betrayal like you just never saw coming. But then, see, he's got five sons. And you don't necessarily even like all of them, but man, the eldest, his name's Rob. Oh, is he good. He's got everything going for him. He's the protagonist to avenge his father and bring justice back to the land. And so he rallies the north, this part of the kingdom, which had been under the thumb of the previous king, who wasn't all bad, but certainly wasn't all good. Anyway, he rallies the north to come back and take it. He's going to become the king. He's going to fix everything. And then he does something stupid. He falls in love, which that's fine. It happens. But he betrays an oath he gave for this love. And he tries to make up for it. He tries to do the right thing. He tries to go and atone for that betrayal. And the man who he betrayed accepts that repentance, says, not a problem at all. Here, let's do this, that, and the other thing, and we'll make it all work. We'll have a big celebration right here in this room to set it all off, and we can move forward. No harm, no foul. Only, in spite of giving bread and salt to him to eat in that very room, which as a historic reality in the world, our world, is a sign of peace, right? Is a sign of safety. He betrays that oath, believing fully he has the right to do so because of the betrayal he'd endured. And he has the young wolf murdered in an ambush at the pinnacle of a wedding. And all of this is really at the behest of that other family, that evil, awful family that always watches out for their own in the most virtuous of ways, the lion, the Lannisters. They plan this because the current king sitting on the throne is not actually the son of the former king, but he's got his name, but he's the son of two of them, and they need to keep him there at all costs. Now, there's a whole lot more to it, and I'll admit it, I'm addicted to the story. Enough so that I'm willing to endure and put aside and look past and deal with the things that bother me, including, I mean, when this happened, when the Red Wedding happened, I'll tell you, I was done. I think it's the end of the third book. Rob dies. Young Wolf dies. I never wanted to read another thing written by George Martin again. I was so betrayed. I was so hurt. How could it be? How could this good man die? Now, of course, the original wolf has more sons, and there's another one that's even more complex and more interesting than Rob. So that's why I kept reading. And yet, don't miss this. There's something beautiful about a story that's honest enough to tell you the good guys don't always win. Now, none of that is exactly why we're talking about this, though. What George Martin does in the Game of Thrones that we do need to, like, pull on for Revelation chapter 7 is this idea of using sigils or imagery, standards, not just flags, right? But a taking a beast or a thing, two towers over a bridge, a wolf, right? And making that thing the identity of your people, the identity of your family. Now, he didn't just pull this out of fantasy literature. This is something that has been done in human history regularly. You probably even have a family crest. You might go look, it might not be as cool as you want when you go look it up. I looked up one of mine a long time ago. It was really dull and boring looking. But nonetheless, the idea was that that meant something once. That was a symbol of something once. It bound the family together in their identity. And this is not only something that humanity is no stranger to, the Bible is no stranger to this. Israel of old is no stranger to this. And I really mean it when I say that this is the hook to getting the glorious beauty out of Revelation chapter 7. Now, there's a whole lot more in Revelation chapter 7. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of other beauty. John has watched these six seals be opened that have shown us all the things that are taking place behind our reality, particularly the fall of the demonic realm and what it's done to the creation as it currently exists, including the persecution of those who are saved and who do believe, and leading up to even the darkening of the sun itself because creation has to end, and it does so in the body of a single man, Jesus Christ. Now, he hasn't mentioned that single man, but you're supposed to put that all together because he's already been risen and shown you his scars and is the lamb, sacrificial lamb, sitting on the throne, who's opening these seals in the first place. So you have all this going on. And you got the condemnation of the world that comes with it. And John looks and he sees those four angels that are managing death and famine and plague and warfare and all the destructive things throughout the whole earth. He sees them being held back. And he sees this other angel with the sun on his mind and on his shield, the seal of the living God in his hand, which we know from ancient Revelation and Ezekiel is actually the cross again. He sees him crying out with a loud voice, proclaiming that the destruction will not come until all of the elect, until all of the chosen, until all of the saved, until you have been strengthened and confirmed in the faith unto life everlasting. And as that's taking place, John hears the number of those who are sealed. Now, I want you to just zoom in for a second before we go forward. I want you to just hear that John hears the number. Because we're going to have to get into a little more numerology here, right? That the numbers in Revelation have very clear symbolic meanings, that they are not intended to be taken literally. In the sense of the seven churches that Jesus sends letters to, well, there's more than seven churches there, but he sends to seven because seven is the number of the church, right? So there are these Old Testament realities in these numbers that we have to let interpret for us the scripture we see before us. And so the number that John hears sealed, or we're going to have to look at that, that this is not an actual physical number, but it means something more. But notice this first, too, that he hears the number. He never sees 144,000 people. Now, why is this important? Well, we're looking at Revelation 7, verse 4. He's going to say that number is the 144,000 who are sealed. And then he goes off to distract us by talking about that 144,000 broken down as groups of 12,000. And we're going to come back. We're going to talk about that. It's really important. But it's a distraction. It's a distraction from the important thing to catch in the text. That the angel is going to seal the saved, and John hears the number that are sealed, and after this, verse 9, skip all the numbers, after the initial number, after he hears that there's 144,000 to be sealed, he looks, and he doesn't see 144,000. He sees a great multitude that no one can number, that nobody can count. Now, why is this important? This is important in twofold, so that we can understand that this is the same group, and we can apply everything that we learn about this group from the number itself and the description of it that comes in verses 5 through 9, 5 through 8. But also then the inverse, that we don't make the mistake of reading this like some sort of linear history, where we have these two different groups, where we're looking for some literal 144,000 to happen at some time, like the Jehovah's Witnesses would teach has already taken place. And this is important, too, in that it's going to inform the way we handle other things, like the reign of 1,000 years of Christ. Because we're already getting that number 1,000 built into this reality here. Now, if you got your Bible, I mean, I really recommend looking at this. Look at verse 4, skip verses 5 to 8, and look at verse 9, and you can't miss it. That he hears a number, and he sees a number, and the number that he hears is figurative, because what he sees is beyond numbering. Now, hold that in your back pocket till we get to the end of the show. But back to the number itself. He hears the number that are sealed. 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. He's going to go on, he's going to list 12,000 from 12 different tribes. Now, before we get into that, though, let's just deal with that number all by itself. Although he's giving you the big hint, right? 12? That should mean something, right? Oh, yes. 12 is the number of the tribes of Israel. 12 is the number of the apostles. We've talked about this back with the 24 elders reality, right? That by virtue of Jacob having 12 sons, 12 became the number of the church. The number of the saved. Not literally, but as an image, as a sigil. And we're going to talk about sigils again on a different issue, but think about it that way. So just as 7 is the emblem of God's rest and God's holiness, so 12 is the emblem of being chosen by God. Now you have 12 times 12, which again is like 24, right? Only instead of adding it, you're multiplying it. So by doubling that reality of two 12s, whether you do it as a product or as a sum, either way, you have two sets of 12, one on either side of Jesus himself. 12 times 12, 144. Okay, so where does this 1,000 come from? And this is pretty key, too, in that the 1,000-year reign of Christ is coming later, but 1,000 is another important number from the Old Testament that just happens to be multiplied by itself 3 times. And 3 happens to be another important number from the Old Testament. 3 should drive you home real fast, right? Holy, holy, holy is Lord God Almighty. And you know, from a New Testament point of view, the Trinity, the 3-in-1, it's kind of the most evident numbered reality that there is. So you have 10 cubed, God's 10. And what's 10? Well, think back to your commandments, right? How many words did God speak from the burning mountain? He spoke 10. And from there, 10 became the number of completion, the number of totality, the number of finishedness. If you got 10, well, you're done. I mean, you don't go higher than a perfect 10, right? We still use that these days. So now we got 12 times 12 times 10 cubed. Now, if you do the math on that thing, what you then have is God's complete perfect salvation of his church. Ooh, did you follow that? I'm going to say it again. God's 3, complete 10. Saved people, 12 times 12, the church. 144,000 is what John hears. He hears the number of salvation. The number which preaches salvation from the Old Testament. Oh, isn't it beautiful? It's beautiful. He hears them sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then it gets really boring as you start reading because you're like, oh my goodness, it reads just like the book of Numbers. 12,000 from every tribe, from the tribe of Judah were sealed. 12,000 from the tribe Reuben, 12,000 from Gad, and Asher, and Naphtali, and Manasseh, and Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun. Oh, Joseph. I remember Joseph. He's got a cool story. Benjamin, right. He was Joseph's brother. Okay, cool. Oh, we got to keep going. That was pretty boring. Just like the book of Numbers. Yeah, exactly. Just like the book of Numbers, only nothing like the book of Numbers, which is kind of the point. So the first thing to remember that you just don't notice when you read this is that the names of the tribes listed here are not like any of the 10 to 20 different places where the names of the sons of Israel are listed in the Old Testament. It's wrong. I mean, if you're an atheist and you're a fundamentalist, one of those atheists that was a fundamentalist and became an atheist and so reads the Bible as if you're searching for the contradictions, here, right here. You got it. It's the wrong list. These are not the sons of Israel. It's not the way it's listed anywhere in the Old Testament. John really messed up. Or, there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. But before we handle that, let's go back to that. Wait, it looks a lot like the Book of Numbers thing. And the listing of the tribes like this, in this way, and see what other major picture is being displayed for us before we try to apply the answer to the question, why is this the wrong list? And right, this is the whole point of what we're doing here with Revelation Unleashed. The whole point is every verse in the book of Revelation has an Old Testament parallel, and your job, if you're going to pretend to know what the book means, is to go look up and read those Old Testament verses. So, like I said a moment ago, and I wish I'd had my notes in front of me when I said it, there's 16 Old Testament lists. Genesis 35, 23, it gives them the way we would maybe expect it, in birth order. All right, so the oldest to the youngest. There's other lists that will give you the order of the land allotment that they get when they enter the promised land. Which then leads to this issue where you end up having some real shifting from that original birth order list, because Levi doesn't get any land because his sons were made into priests, the priests and the Levites. Not all of them were priests, right? But some of them were, and then the rest were to serve the priests. So Levi gets left out of some of the lists, and so does the one that you remember so well, Joseph. Because Joseph has these two sons that his father Jacob/Israel blesses with a double portion back when Genesis 30 is giving all the blessings to the sons of Israel. So that Manasseh and Ephraim each become their own tribe. And they get their own land portion. So when you get those land lists, no Joseph, no Levi, but you got Manasseh and Ephraim. But nowhere did these lists show up with the numbers of thousands like they do when they show up in the book of Numbers. And this is cool. This takes us back to Numbers chapter 1 and chapter 2, which, just like the section we just read from Revelation, is tremendously boring on the surface. It just is like dry as bones. I mean, you know this, right? Anytime you try to read the whole Bible, what do? You, like an idiot, I'm one too, I'm not calling you names, I did the same thing, but like an idiot, you're like, well, I'm going to start at the beginning. And so you go to the beginning and you read Genesis and you're like, yeah, we're doing pretty well, because Genesis reads like a story, well, like a history. Careful there. And then you read Exodus, it's like, that's pretty good too, until like a little later in the book, and then it's starting to sound like Numbers. And it's like, oh, I'll get through it, but you get through it, you know, there's a given the law, oof. And you get to Leviticus, you're like, whoa, this is tough. What am I supposed to do with a spleen? Oh my goodness, right? And then you're like, you get through that, you're like, whew, good. Now we'll probably get back to something good. And then Numbers. It just is mind-numbing. Of the people of Zebulun, their generations, by their clans, by their father's houses, according to the number of the names, from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go to war, those listed of the tribe of Zebulun were 57,400. Of the people of Joseph, namely, of the people of Ephraim, their generations, by their clans, by their father's houses, according to the number of the names, from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go to war, those listed in the tribe of Ephraim were 40,500. I'll stop. It is repetitive. Mind-numbingly, almost as if you wanted to audibly memorize it, repetitive. And that's kind of the key there, is there's this audible memorization. But lost in this, well, what's going on? Where are they when this is taking place? They are in the wilderness of Sinai. They are sitting there at the base of this mountain that's on fire on top, day and night, with a cloud and a deep darkness, because God himself is just chilling there in all of his divine glory. And they have, at this point, received the fullness of the law, both the Ten Commandments and the covenant itself, according to the Levitical promises. And they have ratified, they have holyified that reality, and are preparing now to leave Sinai and head straight to the promised land, which God had sworn to give to their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, 400 plus years before this. And they're going to head to that land, and they're going to settle there forever as a blessing to the entire world. And as they prepare to do this, they're also aware, on more than one level, that not everyone's going to be happy about this, particularly the world that wants to stay running its own show. Particularly the pagan world that doesn't want this God, who is real, as real as a piece of fire on a mountain, right? The world and the pagans don't want this God to run everything, because they'll have to stop sacrificing their babies and praying to fertility goddesses and all this kind of stuff. So part of this reality, as an image of the final day of judgment, by the way, part of this reality is that Israel is going to go to war. They're not just getting ready to go kind of wander like you maybe remember them from the Prince of Egypt movie as they're singing songs wandering through the Red Sea, you know, just a bunch of old people with their goats. This is a massive, massive army sitting at the foot of a burning mountain the second year after they've come out of the land of Egypt, preparing to go and conquer the world. And God has them take a census, and in the census, they get all these numbers of the total groups of people that are there at this time. That's chapter 1. Those who were listed, whom Moses and Aaron listed with the help of the chiefs of Israel, 12 men each represented his father's house. So all those listed of the people of Israel by their father's houses from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go to war. All those listed, 603,550. That's not women and children, people. That's a 600,000-manned army. The Levites aren't counted in this because they are the priests, again, or the ones who serve the priests, I should say. And then it drives that point home for you. Their job is to take care of all the stuff that goes with the covenant. Basically, a house made for God that's a box that sits in a tent. They have to handle everything that goes on around that, particularly the blood and the animals that get connected to that, so that this God that's in this box doesn't burn the Israelites to death, because they're still sinners. They're still murderers in their hearts. They're just set apart. They're just made holy by the presence of God himself and by the blood atonement, which, yes, of course, is all actually Jesus on the cross, that blood atonement. But here it's in type and shadow. So you have this, not a temple, right? It's a tabernacle. It's a tent that is a temple, specially made with golden thread and beautiful woven cloth, with this golden box in the middle. It's sitting there, and the Levites who care for this are to camp around it. That is, as they are living right then and as they go on, whenever they make camp, whenever they set up to sleep for the night, they are to surround entirely this tabernacle, this mobile temple, this mobile sanctuary. And this setup for the Levites themselves and the priests as well, it isn't just ramshackle. They're set up in a very particular way. It's that there are three camps of the Levites, each of them separated into different companies, all the way down to different families, each with his own standard, the text says. There's three of them that are the Levites, and they're to camp on three sides. And then there's a whole other camp on the east side, that the entrance point to the tabernacle, that's strictly the sons of Aaron, which is to say the priests themselves. So can you imagine this then? These four different camps of this very set apart priesthood and like sub-priesthood, but they are behind the images, the pictures of their father's houses, all orderly, lined up in squares, right? Now, we have an issue there right off the bat. And if we, well, I'm not going to tell you what it is. If you picked it up on it, something I need to explain, we'll come back to it. But let's finish the picture first. If you picked up on it, good for you. But it's not just the Levites. Numbers 2 verse 1 says this. It says, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, the people of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' houses. They shall camp facing the tent of meeting on every side." And then it proceeds to list out how they should do it. And again, it's about the driest reading you could possibly imagine. But the picture is pretty stinking cool. So here's how it breaks down. And it's, you got to do some piecing together from a number of different texts to get this. But you have three tribes on each side. So you got the, remember, there's the tabernacle in the middle, there's a square of Levites and priests around it, and then going out in each direction, you have three camps on each side. So really, you have one camp on each side made up of three different tribes. These are huge! Don't get me wrong. These are absolutely huge. But each of these tribes and the camp in front has levels of symbol or levels of flag or standard or banner that's in front of them. And that at the front of each of these three tribes, there's sort of a head tribe that holds the front end, that their banner is underneath even this tribe's quarter banner. So you have one nation with four quarters, each quarter broken into three. Each of the three is broken into 12. Each of those broken down even further, all with this sway of various imagery to represent them and give them identity from top to bottom, to bind them together and yet keep them separate as well. Now you see where the Game of Thrones imagery is coming in now, right? And the setup is, again, it's just really cool. It's very telling. The order is on purpose. On the east side, in the direction that the priests themselves sit, you have three tribes, all sons of Leah, that is, all sons of the first wife of Jacob. Remember, he has two wives and two concubines. But isn't it fascinating? They're not the firstborn. The firstborn, the order is Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, four sons, all born to Leah. Then you have other sons that are born first. I mean, you know, after Judah. But Dan and Naphtali are both born to Bilhah, the maidservant of Rachel. And you have Gad born to Leah's servant. And then Asher also born to Leah's servant. And then you got, well, then Leah has some more kids. She has Issachar and Zebulun. So the last three children born to Leah are Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Isn't that interesting? They're the ones on the east side of the tabernacle. And guess who's at their head? Well, not the last born, right? No, but Judah. And I can't remember if we've talked about this before, but the reason for that, you remember this? There's a reason for that. These other sons that were born beforehand did some bad stuff. Right? Reuben, the firstborn who should have inherited the promises from his father Jacob, well, he goes and he sleeps with Bilhah, the maidservant of his mother's sister, who's also the mom of some of his brothers, right? And so Jacob's not too happy about that. And then Simeon and Levi, after their sister Dinah is raped, go and murder an entire city. And Dad wasn't too happy about that one either, especially because it made him into a perjurer and a liar. So the fourthborn basically becomes the firstborn in terms of the inheritance of the covenant at that point. That's Judah. Judah, who would eventually, in lineage, bring forth David, right? Who would eventually, in lineage, bring forth Jesus. I mean, this is just huge. So Judah's sitting there at the very front of the tabernacle's like door behind the priests, but he's right there in line with the priests. And his two brothers that did not rebel are under his standard and then having their own standards. Now this leaves three sons of Leah, three of the first wife's sons, outside of that camp, right? Well, one of them's the Levites, Levi. So that he's already taken care of. So you really only have two that are left. and there to the south, there you find, camped, Reuben, Simeon, and then Gad, underneath the banner of Reuben. So now you got the firstborn in his proper place, just kind of out of place, yeah? But Reuben and Simeon are there, and then Gad, well, who's Gad? He is the firstborn of Zilpah, which is kind of interesting because you skip over Leah's maidservant, Bilhah's children, and jump to Rachel's maidservant's child, which in this sense is the first child born to Rachel, but not actually to Rachel, right? But it's Rachel's maidservant against Leah, the real person. And now here they are brought together. And so this is a real bonus, right? I mean, Gad being put in with Reuben and Simeon, this is like a big deal. It's like a step up. It's a recognition. Although it's not like the other tribes don't have some awesome going on, because guess who's to the west then? Rachel's actual children. But wait, she only had two, right? Joseph and Benjamin? Except for that she doesn't. She has three because Joseph gets the double portion. And so there you have, to the west, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Benjamin. But who's in the front? And this is so key to so much of what we've already talked about with the history of the kings. It's Ephraim. Ephraim, that mighty people of double portion, so often distinguished in battle in the book of Joshua and Judges and elsewhere, who eventually will take the northern kingdom for themselves after God sends Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, of the tribe of Ephraim, to wrest away the kingdom from Solomon's son Rehoboam. So you got Ephraim with Benjamin and Manasseh behind, to the west, the sons of Rachel. Behind their standards and sigils all the way, right? And more of that coming. But to the north, then, what does that leave us? It leaves us Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, which is all children born to the maidservants, right? So Gad got boosted up by being the firstborn of Rachel by proxy. But all the remaining children born to maidservants are on the north side. Behind the sigil of Dan, right? He's the fifth son overall, right after Judah, firstborn to Bilhah. So it all kind of makes sense. And it makes it even more cool, again, to imagine the 600,000 people, men, of fighting age. You got more beyond that. But they're all arrayed like this as an actual army, camping to protect the thing at the center. What's at the center of most armies? The king's tent. Well, what's at the center here is that it's the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I mentioned earlier that we have a problem. And this problem is that this is the same group of people that God has pretty much said, you're not supposed to make images because you might worship them. Now, of course, as Lutherans, we don't believe he actually said that, right? That the no graven images isn't its own commandment, but is in fact instead a commandment not to bow down or worship images, false gods. And we make this argument on a number of levels. I mean, the chief of which is that even Leviticus has them making the cherubim out of gold and sewing pomegranates into the tent itself, things like that. So it's not like we really have a problem with there being actual banners with pictures on them. Although if you are Reformed, you should. It should be kind of like, what's going on here? But I think I got an answer for you. You don't even have to. You can go to the, well, it's not graven. Okay, whatever. If it's an icon, it's an icon. If it's an image, it's an image. You can bow down and worship it, even if it's not three-dimensional. But the thing is, we don't really know what these were at all. It's helpful to me to think about Game of Thrones and the Young Wolf's banner. If you've ever seen the Stark banner, I got a t-shirt. I love the wolf's head, right? Waving in the wind with the army marching behind and all the smaller houses with their banners not quite as high coming up behind it. I mean, it's helpful to think about that. But, you know, you also recognize that Hebrew itself is a fairly pictorial language. I mean, it's not like Japanese writing where it's all pictographs, right? But it's a beautiful, beautiful set of images. And there's no reason why that a letter or some other form of script cannot form as these sigils or banners. But for the sake of, well, helping to picture it, I'm going to just kind of sit back on what the rabbis said about this. Now, I don't think they're right. I actually think this is not true. I think it's very unlikely. As possible. Here's what they say of these major standards that all the four major camps, of which three tribes are in each camp, around them, what these standards are. So to the east, where Judah Issachar and Zebulun camp, the dutiful sons of Leah who did as they ought. There waves in the air a banner with a marvelous roaring lion. To the south, where Reuben, firstborn over all, and his rebellious brother Simeon and Gad, who was born in not the best kind of circumstances or way, there they are behind the sigil of a man, strong and mighty, mouth open, ready to speak. To the west, where Rachel's children, led by mighty Ephraim, sit. Upon what? A field of green? You see flapping in the breeze the strong back and mighty horns of an ox, ready to charge, ready to pull, ready to do what needs to be done. And to the north? Can you guess yet what's coming? What is it on? A field of purple? I don't know. There, soaring upon its wings of strength, flies the eagle of Dan. And who would not rally to his cry? Yeah? You see it? Now, the rabbis only tell us, at least so far as I know, about these four. And where'd they get this? Well, from the seraphim, right? The cherubim in Isaiah and in Ezekiel. And John picks up on this. We saw them also in the psychoangel beasts and all that. That's why I'm like, I'm not so sure. This is a little too easy, right? Like, it's a little too much like we copied. And while it does make sense, I mean, the lion with Judah, because that's actually mentioned in the blessing given to him by Israel, none of those other things are really mentioned in those blessings. And if you're looking for some other idea, I mean, each of these guys' names has a meaning in and of itself, right? So Simeon means to hear or hearing. So maybe they had a picture of an ear. I mean, it's not the ear. Not exactly exciting, right? But, you know, Dan means to judge, and Naphtali is to wrestle. I mean, all of these have images that are connected to them that you can also just kind of put into the picture as you like. I mean, it's not that hard to think of Benjamin, son of my right hand, as some sort of, like, strong, powerful right fist, right? But no matter how you envision it, it does give you a pretty cool picture. So that by the time you get to the end of this description, in Numbers chapter 2, verse 34, where it says that they set out from the mountain, they broke camp, they ordered up in this order, one at a time, to go traipsing across the land. I mean, what a sight this would have been with all of these banners waving in the air. Well, it's a picture to behold. And you add to this, as Numbers 9:15 says, that they're not alone. That fiery God who was chilling up on the mountain, he'd come down and, like, buried the tabernacle after they had consecrated it in the cloudiness of himself. And at evening, over the tent in the middle of them, as this army, again, banners waving everywhere, there's this appearance of fire. It's glowing at the heart. A cloud by day and fire by night. And then this cloud, to let them know it's time to go, to set out, and this happened every time, but the first time it had to be just a stunning thing. This cloud kind of congeals and the fire catches inside of itself and it lifts up into the sky as a, what? I don't know, a pillar of cloud. I mean, what do you call it? But how do you even imagine that? A glorious angelic being of darkness? Fire mixed with shadow? I mean, the Balrog's not exactly the way I like to think of Yahweh, but... there's some of that going on here. And as this shadowy fire being is lifting up into the air, there are two silver trumpets of hammered fine work that start blaring a long, unending blast, not the sound of an alarm, but like the beginning of creation itself. Right? Sorry if that was weird, but this silvery, unending blast as the cloud rises over the flapping banners of lion and eagle and man and ox. And then some more. This is the priests blowing these trumpets. And these same trumpets were used when they go to war. When they go to war, they were to sound the alarm on these same trumpets that they might be remembered before the Lord their God, so that God himself will go to war with them, leading the way with his angelic fiery hosts. saving them from their enemies. And so also on all days of gladness, all days of feasts, and at the beginning of every single month when they had a celebration appointed by God himself to happen, they blew those same trumpets over their burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings. A reminder. The trumpets, a reminder. I am the Lord your God. Right? The one who brought you out of Egypt. The one who goes with you wherever you need to go. The one who leads you in the way. The one who is at your heart and midst and center. Not as a fiery demon, but as a king. A king who will never let your nation fall and will lead you into a land, a paradise flowing with milk and honey. Now, it says something that then by the time they get up there, they kind of run away with their tail between their legs, afraid to go in. But nonetheless, take all that back and put it into that moment where that angel from the sun says, I got to put crosses on their foreheads. Do not touch them, you wicked ones, until I have. And John hears the number of the sealed. God's complete people. And he hears it called out in the marching order of the martial, unconquerable, indefatigable armies of Israel, in their orders, with their banners flying, swords at hip, trumpets ready to blast, to conquer all evil once and for all. 12,000 from the tribe of, notice who's first. Judah. Judah, from whom comes the lion and the lamb as one. 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben. The firstborn now, pushed up to the top. 12,000 from the tribe of Gad, firstborn of Zilpah, which means firstborn of Rachel, in a strange way. And then it gets kind of weird, because then you have Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Now that's eight. And I skipped one. You have four and then four. In the middle of those four and then four, you have Levi. Now, first things first. If you remember your camp order, I know it's kind of hard to picture, but you're moving around the back end. You're skipping half of the guys who the rabbis bother to give us sigils for. You're skipping the heads of the clans. In particular, because two have been mentioned, Judah and Reuben, but the other two, in particular, Dan and Ephraim. And you're replacing them with, two guys who don't belong there. I mean, really, Dan and Ephraim are gone, and you're replacing them with Joseph, who's Ephraim's dad, but also Manasseh's dad, and Manasseh does get mentioned, so it's really weird, and then Levi, who gets no portion of the land at all, so why is he even in the marching order to begin with? Now, there's some debate about this amongst the scholars, but I really think they make more of it than they need to because it's just not that hard. Ephraim and Dan, more than any of the other tribes, are publicly, symbolically, standards, as it were, of idolatry and rebellion. So, for example, in Judges 18, it's people from Dan who take the ephod made by this priest, this really false priest Micah, who'd been serving in this guy's house with this idol, this ephod that he made. They take Micah and the priest and his idol and bring it back to their own land after killing the guy who had it so they could get it from him, right? And they then go upon a city called Laish, filled with quiet, unsuspecting people. They murder them all. They burn it with fire. They rebuild it and they name it Dan. Yeah. They set up that carved image for themselves there and it's just... well, it's bad. In fact, it tells us in Judges, his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So this false religion that they set up actually lasts all the way through even Solomon's reign. It's, you know, Dan as a name is associated with idolatry. Go figure. I mean, even Jacob didn't like him much. I mean, what kind of blessing is this to give to your son? Right. Dan shall judge his people. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. I mean, thanks, Dad. But, you know, unless, well, unless it's an accurate description and it's just straight up true. And it certainly is true of Dan's name as a symbol. So you got Dan as a problem there, and then Dan is connected to Ephraim. When Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, comes back after Solomon's death from Egypt, because he'd kind of been against Solomon a little bit as well and was in danger, he comes back and he overthrows half of the kingdom that had been ruled by Rehoboam. He builds Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim as his capital. And we've talked about this before. He figures out that if he doesn't do something to truly divide the religion of his people from that of the son of David, then they're going to turn back to the Lord, and then he's going to lose the kingdom. So he's got to come up with a new set of gods. And so what does he do? He takes counsel, and he goes and he makes two new golden cows, right? Oh, yeah, you people and the golden cows. He goes and makes two more calves of gold. And he says to the people as he presents them, "Behold your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And he puts one in Bethel and the other one in, wait for it, in Dan. So now you got both Ephraim and Dan as the center of idolatry in the north, which leads to their total devotion to fire, right? To their total destruction, and connects them to that nasty, disobedient, unbelieving, dancing and playing with sexual favors around the golden cow at the foot of the mountain where God himself was actually sitting, ready to send out his army. And then he's got the army in rebellion below him, right? All of that, all those images just congealing. So that when it's up to St. John, well, or the Revelation directly, both and, to convey to us the picture of those sealed, that is, saved from out of the destructive idolatry of the earth, the true Israel, God's perfected, complete army, not to fight, but to be fought for. When he wants to symbolize that reality using the 12 heads of the 12 tribes from the past, he picks a purified list, a list in which idolatry in real life, harder to find, but in the picture in which idolatry does not exist. So, oh ye Mr. Fundamental Atheist, it's not an accident and it's not an error. It's a sermon. It's a proclamation that this number that John hears is more than just a perfect number. It is a perfected number. It is a people that are perfected by the body and blood of that Lamb, Jesus. So that when John hears this number shouted out, and then he turns, and he looks, and he sees this multitude that no one can number and count from every nation, from all tribes, peoples, and languages, right? With their sigils, with their histories, with their cultures, only all brought underneath the throne of the Lamb. He sees them standing before the throne, clothed in white robes with these palm branches, images of victory in their hand. Well, there's no question in his mind what this is what it's what Israel always was supposed to be. And they were by faith alone, just like you and I. Well, we don't exactly live up to the image right now, but we are by faith alone. The church in every place, Old and New Testament together, is more than conquerors. It might look chaotic to you, but we're standing in organized fighting rows. Sword of the Spirit, armor of light, all of that, totally with us all the way. Marching according to the trumpet call of our God. With him at the center, with him, the King, reigning from the middle of us. In the seal of the cross. Washed upon our foreheads. 12,000 sealed. 12,000 sealed, 12,000 sealed, and the banners of the Son of David flapping in the wind, Lion of Judah, Lamb of God. I mean, it may not be Game of Thrones, but Numbers isn't nearly as boring as you thought, huh?
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.